Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. First thing on the top of the program is the podcast is now a call-in podcast. Call me anytime with thoughts, queries, concerns. And if you want to feature on the podcast, we can certainly do that. I can record the phone call if you wish. I'd love to hear people's opinions on the finals and things. The number is 0499 396 818. That's 0499 396 818. I never know quite how to read these numbers in sequence, but there you go. There it is nonetheless. And it's on my Twitter account. Call through if you have an opinion, or if you feel like I've outspoken, or if there's even players or coaches or personnel or management close to the situation. You want to say, oh, actually, you know, we didn't like what you said there, or we want to give you great information. By all means, give me a call, email. I'm very open. Enjoy.
What it is, it's basketball. It's not a f***ing soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. We find ourselves in strange circumstances. I'm recording this Thursday, the 19th of March, at about 10 o'clock in the morning. So hopefully I'm saying things and they haven't been superseded with new news, but let's find out. Little advice to everyone. I put out a little funny little trailer on the Twitter account. Check that out. That was a bit of fun. Now it looks dated, but whatever. And to remind everyone, because this podcast is going to have some conversations that perhaps people don't particularly want to touch on, but just want to reiterate the mythology or methodology of this podcast. It's to give or inspire a different thought. I'm not a newsbreaker. I do a lot of reading. I watch a lot of the press conferences. I watch obviously a lot of the games, if not all of them. And I chat to a few people around the league, but ultimately this is about looking at what's happened, looking about what's been written, pulling all these thoughts together and then having given them a bit of a jumble and having to think about it. So with that in mind, let's jump on to the grand final, cancelled. Crazy news, obviously really disappointing for everyone, players, coaches, fans. You know, this was the worst possible outcome and it's exactly what's happened. Let's go ahead and look at how this happened, step by step, and what was said, and whether we agree or disagree. So the league office owners and the Australian Basketball Players Association were the major players in this decision. The NBL did a daily check-in with these players and said, are you okay to keep going with the current strategy? Perth Wildcats obviously have said yes. The Sydney Kings have been up until, what was it, Tuesday, in agreement, and then eventually they got asked the question, and then the reply to the NBL was, actually, we're meeting about it, and then the answer ultimately came out in the press conference that the answer was a no. Liam Santamaria on NBL Overtime asked a really good question of Jeremy Lowliger, and if you haven't watched this, definitely go and watch it. He asked, are you surprised to see the finals cancelled without a player having tested positive to COVID-19 or coronavirus, which has been the big predeterminer in whether a sports gets cancelled? NBA, Rudy Gobert, EPL, a number of players and managers, so on and so forth. A-League is still playing. They haven't turned in a positive result yet. I believe netball's still going. That hasn't turned in. So, interesting. Lowliger kind of responded to that. He goes and responded to the idea of continuing the series. He says, we were open. We were acting in accordance with government advice. At no point did any government state that it wasn't safe to fly domestically. Government, our chief medical officer in Brendan Murphy, and the health ministers of the respective states, that was the basis on which we were going to proceed. So the NBL is not just looking for the big buck here or the dollar. It's relying on people who are very credible in both the field of health, most importantly, and secondly, travel. Pongress said in the press conference, Chris Pongress, general manager of Sydney Kings, I think that's his title. He said, a desire to win and play for each other set aside so many variables that include air travel, immigration restrictions for international players, and an overall sense of responsibility to meet community standards of action to limit the spread of COVID-19. So they're the three things that the Sydney Kings have decided to call the series on. Air travel and perhaps the health implications of that or just the logistic concerns of that, immigration restrictions for international players, and a social responsibility, which are all fair reasons, but let's dissect all three. Weaver spoke about our broader global community and a responsibility to them. When asked about crowning a champion, Weaver replies, not to be flippant, but it couldn't matter less to us. The relevance of the competition is so greatly diminished by the circumstances of this health crisis. Paul Smith in the press conference says, why should athletes in our sport or any sport be held to a higher standard than any other employee, any other professional? What are we trying to do here? We're not trying to game anyone. It's about people. So let's try and dissect a couple of these things. Let's do Paul Smith first. And my question to Paul and everyone out there listening would be, are they being held to a higher standard? The NBL is trying everything it can do under crazy circumstances to allow them to continue to perform safely, and is doing that with the consultation of some really bright minds in the field. To see it as sort of exploiting these athletes here, I just think that may be a little bit crass. It is one way to look at the situation, and I don't think it's an unreasonable one to do. But it's also a way of looking at you could also take this spin, which is what I have. We value what you do so much, the fans and seemingly the NBL itself. We are willing to manipulate the schedule, close stadiums, take a financial hit, charter flights. Now, I don't know who was going to fit the bill of the charter flights. Could be the owners themselves. So, but at no point has anyone said this has become monetarily unsustainable. But, you know, the NBL is willing to do all these things to let you to continue your craft. If it was a painter in this circumstances and they said, well, we're going to get you on a flight that's safe, we're going to move the schedule around for you, we're going to change things, we're going to do whatever we want. We value your painting so much that we're willing to take these chances. It's not, hey, monkey, get over there and paint. I don't think that's what's happened here at all. It's a compliment, not an exploitation, I feel. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Hit me up on the Twitter if you don't think so. I believe Paul Smith goes on to say, how we grow our league is through international players. And if we're going to ignore their concerns in circumstances that are unprecedented and their fear of not being able to return home to their families, and that is a fair concern, absolutely. But at the minute, the USA and Brazil, who I believe are obviously Casper Ware's from Long Beach in California, Jay Sean Tate's from Ohio, or at least went to college there. Did Luzada is from Brazil. There is currently no ban on non-Australian citizens traveling back to their countries of origin. If the two Americans were to fly to the United States, they would have to stop at one of 13 airports for health checks, LAX being one of them, and probably Cleveland's airport or nearby. So the USA remains open to its citizens. Europe is a different concern, but I don't know who's traveling to Europe, and more importantly, I don't know who would want to travel to Europe at this point. That would not be the safest place to go. You'd be much safer in Australia. Now, you wouldn't be with your family in the event that they're in Europe, but nonetheless, and I might be speaking out of school there, but I just wanted to say that. Was there pressure from the NBL to finish this series? Presumably, yes. I guess not. Pressure is probably the wrong word. I really do feel like the NBL looked at the circumstances and thought, it is safe to conclude this series. There are two games left. We can do this. We can give NBL, we can have our cake and eat it too, which is probably not the mindset during a health crisis, but it's important to have finished this season. It really is. And that's where I think the frustration of the Wildcats and the NBL stemmed from, the fact that they felt that they could have made conditions to make this series and the conclusion of this series a safe one. This is a question that I'm fearful to ask because I don't want to offend anyone out there, but I feel like there's a responsibility to ask it. Have the Kings operated out of fear? I can't help but feel that this is the basketball equivalent of hoarding toilet paper. And that might sound really crass in question, but you know, I want to put it out there to people. Is this a response done out of looking at all the advice and things? And I'm not privy to the Sydney Kings' inner workings. I have a mobile phone number that people can call me on. I have my Twitter open and email available. If anyone wants to speak to me about this and say you're wrong about this, absolutely get in touch. Happy to rebuke things, happy to hear any and all thoughts. I'm just throwing the ball around. Pardon the pun. It feels like this is an operation out of fear. The Wildcats are not operating out of fear. They seem to be a little bit more rational on this and saying, we want to complete the series. We think there's a safe way we can do this, and we're going to pursue and execute that avenue. And here's why I think, in response to Weaver's comment that, not to be flippant, but we couldn't care less about who wins. I didn't particularly like that answer from him. NBL 20 has seen 9 teams of approximately 110 players from all over the globe play in 252 games, 252 times 40 minutes. It's a lot of basketball. A lot of time and heart and money and effort and valor has been invested into this season. This season was 1 or 2 games away from completion. Two of 252, less than 1%. It's not about being held to a higher standard. It's about being courageous in the face of fear. It's about valor. It's about the spirit of competition, respect for yourself and your opponent, pride, teamwork, professionalism. You know, we are here to do a job, and yes, it's incredibly difficult circumstances, but you don't just drop tools, you run through the tape. This is biomedical terrorism that we're facing. You don't negotiate with terrorists. We've all seen Die Hard. You wash your hands, you don't shake other people's, you minimize your contact with others, you fly safe or charter flights, you observe social distancing. To travel and play these games, these two games, potentially two games, would not have flown in the face of the social responsibility or the global community response to COVID-19, I don't think. And this might be a little over the top, but I want to read a quote. This is from, and this is going to sound pretentious, but I'm going to read it anyway. This is from Shakespeare's King Henry V. Yeah, this is where we're going. He today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed that they were not here, and hold their manhood cheap, while any speaks that fought with us on St. Crispin's Day. You know, this is the crisis that this virus has brought to the fore. This is a question that I'm, again, just bashful or embarrassed or scared about asking, but we don't operate out of fear here. Did Sydney sabotage the conclusion of this series? I asked the question, I'll give my own answer to the question. I don't think they did, but I'll go on. Did they do everything in their power to maintain the integrity of the series? Did they negotiate at every point through the finals in good faith, with the prerogative to conclude the series? A lot of measures, stroke solutions were put forward that the Kings refused, and a lot of them fairly. To say, oh, let's have a three-game series after they've lost game one, that is not fair, and I'm not surprised they refuted that. Could they have hastened travel? The idea that hastening games and only having a day or two's break was a great risk to player health when all through the year there's been a number of two games in one round games played. Was it, you know, there's been a number of those games played. So the fact that one or two more, I think in the interest of finishing the series, in the interest of seeing credible, I don't think that was an unreasonable request of the Wildcats or the NBL if they made that request. It certainly appeared that Perth's primary objective was to conclude the series, and that objective is the most immediate, just, and reasonable. As I've said, I think this didn't could have been included series. And I want to quote I've just quoted Shakespeare. Let's quote someone equally as famous and brilliant. When one can see no future, all one can do is the next right thing. That's from the troll in Frozen 2. Not quite King Henry V and Shakespeare, but pretty damn close. And I think, sort of harping on what Paul Smith said about athletes and things, I don't think there's any shame in identifying as a basketball player predominantly. Not exclusively, but predominantly. It's not a shame for a person to say, I derive my meaning and identity from playing basketball. Not all my identity, but some of it. Or most of it. I derive my identity from playing basketball, so that's what I'm going to do. It's like the band on the Titanic playing to keep warm as the ship goes down. They are musicians. Playing music is what they do. And in a crisis and in a time of great fear, they continue to do that. I also have to ask the question, was this an attempt by the Sydney Kings to align themselves with the big boys of sport? They could see that other big codes had called it off, NBA most, obviously, EPL, NHL, etc. Was it an attempt to say, well, if we conclude our series under this climate and those sports have pulled the pin, what do we look like? Was there a bit of bashfulness on the part there? And I guess it's two different conversations. We were the NBL was two games away from a conclusion. The NBA has got 30 games by each team left in their season, NHL as well. EPL's a bit of a different conversation. They were close to the end of their season, but again, I don't really like to comment on that. I don't know too much. Run through the tape is what I've got written here. The other question I have is the Sydney Kings on game two put out an advertisement to have drinks at the brewery bar in Homebush, you know, a gathering when gatherings were not banned at that point, but certainly frowned upon. I'm wondering if that went ahead. The other question I have was, who was the Kings' quote-unquote independent medical advisor? He, and it is a he because it was not just, it wasn't a he or she, it was in the pronouns used in the press conference, it was definitely a he. He has seemingly informed the Kings players that their immediate and long-term welfare was at risk. And I say, quote-unquote, immediate and long-term welfare at risk because that was the exact terminology used in the Sydney Kings press conference. This information does seem contrary to reports that domestic flights present a low health risk and also the risk of infection to these individual players. And I'm referring explicitly to the thought that immediate and long-term welfare of the players personally. And I've got a stat here from, this is from statnews.com, and they're really interesting if you're looking at it. They give up-to-date stats from top to bottom about this coronavirus. And I just want to give you a few stats on that now while we're looking at it, while we're talking about the immediate and long-term welfare and health of the players. I suppose welfare could also mean mental health, so it's not completely out of the realm of possibility. Nonetheless, there are 375 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Australia, 170 in New South Wales, 28 in WA. This was of yesterday afternoon. There have been 5 people in Australia died from COVID-19. That is now sadly reached 6. The death rate between for people aged 15 to 44 is 0.1 to 0.5%. And that is a death rate calculated by the Wuhan Chinese province, which is the most hardest hit. The death rates for those aged sub 15 years is estimated at low, if not zero. The virus does not seem to present symptoms in people under 15 at this time. So that's that one there. 80% of deaths from COVID-19 are over the age of 60, and 75% of those deaths have a pre-existing health condition, cardiovascular disease and diabetes most predominantly among them. The fatality rate on total is 2%. SARS was 10% and MERS, or Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, was 34%. This was interesting and calming reading from worldometers.info/coronavirus, and definitely check out those. So this independent medical advisor, whoever he may be, has given some information that I would love to see shared and perhaps share it with the Perth Wildcats, who don't share his sentiments, seemingly. To be fair, the one most at risk of coronavirus is Jack Bendit, and he's the only one who hasn't said a word about this whole thing. I want to come back to that idea of meaning. You know, Will Weaver said, and I don't think what Will Weaver said was out of bounds at all when he said not to be flippant, you know, this has, in the face of the global crisis, has lost meaning. I just want to make really reiterate, the NBL title is not meaningless. And that might sound a little fatuous and obvious, but I just wanted to really, things are only as valuable as the value you place on it. Gold is very valuable. Why? Because it's rare. And we place value on things that are rare. Why are antiques expensive or meaningful? Because we place that on them, because they're old. And we talk about, you know, gold being valuable because it's rare. Well, the NBL title comes out of its trophy cabinet but once a year. It matters. It matters a lot. The NBL this season has been nothing but a pillar of strength, spirit of competition, pride, respect, tolerance, brotherhood. I'm giving a whole lot of pretty poetic adjectives, but this season meant a lot. And you need to declare a winner because that way you can have a loser and they can dissect it and you can realize that losing isn't that bad. The NBL title matters. And I'm not saying it doesn't matter to the Sydney Kings at all. I think it matters a great deal, but I feel like some of their methodology, I would love to talk to them about. And that's all I've got to say about that. Let's jump on to more polite and positive things. Just to reiterate, I think Perth were going to win this series. I predicted at the start that once they won game one, and especially once they won game three, this thing was over. As far as a decision being made, we're still waiting today for a decision. It's my suspicion that the NBL will give the championship to the Wildcats. They're up 2-1. And also the fact that the NBL and the Wildcats are standing there going, let's continue to game four. And the Sydney Kings have said, we don't wish to. And that is their decision. And I'm not bitterly disappointed at the decision, but understanding of the decision. But taking a stand in the face of your opponent and the league and seemingly the chief executive health officer who has informed the AFL that they should play, which has a much greater player base and things, to fly in the face of that, I think, you know, it's noble, but unfortunately there comes a cost to being the boss. And as a result, this should be deemed a forfeit for game four. That takes the series to 3-1. I think that's the result that the NBL is going to turn in. It'd be very interesting to see what they do. There is a case to be made for other avenues. I don't think they are as legitimate as that one I just said. As I said, let's go to something more pleasant. Nick Kay and the powered forward spot league-wide. The question I have for you guys out there is his dominance over that position the Wildcats' dirty little secret? And maybe not dirty secret, but certainly a little secret. I really had a look across the league, and you look at Nick Kay, and then you look at the second best power forward or the next little crop of power forwards, and he sort of stands atop of this field well and truly, more so than any position elsewhere. I mean, you'd even look at someone like Bryce Cotton. Bryce Cotton, let's call him a guard. Scott Machado is much closer to Bryce Cotton as the second best guard in the league than the next best power forward is to Nick Kay. And let's just quickly go through the list. So obviously at the top of the list in my power rankings of the power forward spot, you have Nick Kay. I'm going to go through them now in alphabetical order because I really don't know how you'd pick the next best. You've got Eric Griffin and Obi Che in Adelaide, splitting time there, mostly Griffin. You've got Magne and Taylor Braun in Brisbane, most predominantly. In Cairns, you've got Majuk Deng. Now, maybe Cam Oliver, but I mean, Juwai played about 12 to 15 minutes this year. Oliver played most of his minutes at that small ball five, but then so did Kay. So maybe Oliver is the answer to this, but I really feel like he's not the power forward. He didn't line up on Nick Kay a heck of a lot. Melbourne, David Barlow and Stanton Kidd. New Zealand Breakers, Finn Delaney. Southeast Melbourne was Ty Wesley and then Mitch Creek, arguably, but probably not. And then Sydney was probably Jayshon Tate and Xavier Cooks, perhaps. I mean, you look at that power ranking, and if you're at home, well, most people are at home now, get out a pen and paper and just think who's the best power forward, and it's Nick Kay, and then who you think is the best, and kind of maybe give them a rating out of 10 and see where you sit. Because the next best, if it's not Cam Oliver on that list, there's a fair degree of difference between them. And Will Magne is probably the next closest. Finn Delaney probably. Actually, yeah, definitely Finn Delaney. So, but Nick Kay, I mean, he is a boomer and an all-star and a first-teamer. Really special. So sit down with a pen and paper, give them ratings and see how big the drop-off is between who you feel is the best in each position and their second best, and then tabulate the difference. And I think you'll come to the same conclusion that I did, that it's Nick Kay at power forward. A lot of talk's been going on about Bryce Cotton, Leroy Loggins and Ricky Grace, about who's better of these three. And I've spoken about this in the past. This answer to this is fluid. It changes day to day. I want to talk about it again. I think ultimately with this question, it really comes down to something. What's his name? SNL, Saturday Night Live. Lorne Michaels says, whichever your favorite SNL cast, troupe, or crew, is whichever one was on TV when you're in high school. That's his answer to when he gets asked who was the best. And I think it's a little bit of the case here with Cotton, Leroy Loggins, and Ricky Grace. But let's break him down. And I'm going to try and do this as best I can. But Leroy Loggins, 3 championships, 3 MVPs, 1 finals MVP, 2 defensive player of the years, and a PER of 17.3. That's the performance rating that basically tabulates all their stats and looks at player efficiency rating, what they contribute on the court. You want a high number in this instance. Ricky Grace, 4 NBL championships, 0 MVPs for the regular season, 2 finals MVPs, a PER of 19.2. Important to note with these PERs is, obviously, Carlton has only played 4 years of his career, or however long it is, and the others have played the tail end of their career, or non-peak, whereas Bryce hasn't seen that yet. Let's look at Cotton. He's got 2/3 NBL championships. I'm going to say 3. He's got 2 league MVPs, quite a, you know, 2 in inverted finals MVPs, if they grant this year, and a PER of 23.9. And I talked about why that number is high. Just thought I'd lay that out there. In my answer to the question is, certainly the defensive prowess of Loggins is something that's interesting, and I haven't seen enough of his games. I won't pretend to. Ricky Grace, I saw a lot more of. The case by case of the three is Loggins's ability to do it all. Big, long, rangy guy, great defender. You look at that though: 3 championships, 3 MVPs, finals. You know, great resume, but that ability to play all sides of the ball. Ricky Grace, his case is, well, 4 championships for one. But secondly, his ability to get others involved and control tempo. He was an architect of the game. He wasn't the scorer that Cotton is, obviously, but you know, did it differently. And then Cotton, obviously, is just the scoring. This guy's a scoring freak. Best scorer we've ever seen in the league. Yes, I said that. As far as timely baskets and as far as shifting a game with scoring, yeah, I think it's Bryce Cotton. He blows games away. I want to go through an old scouting report on Bryce Cotton by Mike Schmitz of Draft Express. This article, and I'll hopefully provide the link in the description, it details something really interesting. This one by Mike Schmitz, it details a 5-on-5-on-5 tryout by the LA Clippers, or at least hosted by the LA Clippers. And it's a sort of a trial. They got 4 teams of 5. Of the best prospects and put them against each other in actual 5-on-5. Most of the combine is just measurements, verticals, bench press, so on and so forth. This was actually a little tournament amongst the prospects, or at least some of them. Amongst the group that tried out here was, amazingly, Lamar Patterson, Casey Prather, Scotty Wilbekin, and Bryce Cotton. And this is before Bryce is drafted. This is sort of circa 2014, I believe. Schmitz likes, he lists Prather, Wilbekin, as Cotton as notable names from this tournament. He writes of Casey Prather, a non-factor, active on defense but struggled to shoot the ball from the perimeter, failed to deliver offensive creativity outside of right-hand drives to the rim. Does bring toughness and athleticism. That's what he says about Casey Prather. Scotty Wilbekin, unselfish to the tune of 8-1 assist to turnover ratio, great feel out of pick and roll, struggled to shoot from the outside or finish at the rim, but his defense on Bryce Cotton stood out. So what I was getting from this article is, did Scotty Wilbekin cost Bryce Cotton being drafted in the NBA? And obviously your likelihood of staying in the NBA improves exponentially if you have been drafted into the NBA. But nonetheless, let's keep going. Of Cotton, he wrote, didn't have an impact. Found teammates, but his size limitations really stood out. That's a direct quote. Really interesting article. Have a read of it. This is a full scouting report also on Draft Express by Derek Bodner. And what I'm trying to do with this exercise is look at what people predicted of Bryce Cotton in 2014 or just before his draft year, and what he's matured into now, and whether he has addressed the concerns that were there prior to the NBA draft that perhaps could get him there in the future. Let's look at this. This is from Eric Bodner. Cotton scored 22.2 points per game at Providence in his sophomore year at a true shooting percentage of 62%. the top marks for a point guard prospect, 1% below CJ McCollum, who's now been starring for the Portland Trailblazers. Bodner writes, Cotton's primary asset is his jumper and shooting. In his first year, Cotton got 85% of his offense off set shots, catch and shoot instances. In his third year, 37.5% off catch and shoots. He has expanded his game to incorporate shots off the dribble. He also writes of Cotton, he is not a top-end athlete. Struggles finishing over length and through contact. Does, however, do a good job of drawing contact. 7 free throw attempts per 40 minutes. So when we were looking at this series, and Will Weaver had said that, you know, Cotton is drawing fouls at a rate we haven't seen before. We haven't seen it before, but it's not totally unprecedented. Cotton has an ability to draw contact and get fouled and go to the foul line. Did in college, had earlier in his NBL career, and certainly was doing it in these NBL finals. While a low assist rate, this is back to Bodner, while a low assist rate, Cotton does not appear to have a very instinctual, does not appear to be a very instinctive passer with relatively mediocre court vision, recognition, and ability to control tempo. If you're listening along at home, think about that. Does Cotton have ability as an instinctive passer? Does he have relatively mediocre court vision, recognition, and does he have a relatively mediocre ability to control tempo? I thought about that. That gave me pause, and I'm sure it does for you at home as well. Bodner writes, the threat he provides scoring off the pick and roll gives him some opportunities to create offense for teammates, but he is, by and large, not able to capitalize on the attention he receives. And this will be a major question mark for him moving forward, as his size limits his ability to play off the ball. This is the even bigger question than that one before. The threat he provides going through gives him so much, but he is by and large not able to capitalize on the attention he receives. You look at what Cotton has done in these finals against the stinging, the double teaming, the drops. The one time where this assessment of his game holds up is against Cairns, when DJ Newball, the longer, bigger defender, and the doubling, did stymie Cotton, and as a result, they did take a game off Perth. So that sentence is one for you to really consider. I haven't quite come up with an answer to it. I think Cotton, that is his struggle. If you're going to double team a guy, especially at quarter court, it's a really difficult circumstance. I mean, Perth did come out of that series with Cairns, and he was playing against a much bigger defender in Newball and wasn't totally rendered obsolete. So, tough one, but that's a question for you guys out there. He writes, for a player who carries the ball as much as Cotton, his 1.9 turnovers per 40 minutes is one of the better ranks among point guards. And I think that is an issue of Cotton is putting it up on the rim. It's kind of like, well, a batsman in cricket doesn't get bowled a lot if he's getting caught a lot, because if you swing and hit at everything, you're not going to get bowled, but you will get caught, which is the same. But to me, that's an interesting thing with Cotton. His hyper-aggression in scoring is, and in answer to that question from before about controlling tempo and scoring, his ability to control tempo comes off his scoring, which is so reliable, and his shooting. On defense, his overall size, length, and average athleticism will likely render him physically overmatched at the next level. And he will obviously be limited to defending the point guard spot. Has that changed? I don't know if his average athleticism, I mean, compared to a lot of guys perhaps, but he is limited to defending the point guard spot, unless it's someone who can't shoot, who's bigger. But I don't know if that has necessarily changed that assessment. With the defensive concerns and his lack of experience running an offense, the situation Cotton comes into may be more important than most when determining whether he can stick on an NBA roster. This I couldn't agree more, and I had it listed in bold. The situation Cotton comes into is more important than anything else. That could probably be said of 99.9% of NBA prospects, especially all those drafted in the second round. With the learning curve Cotton has shown to date and only being 21 for the entirety of his senior season, he will certainly be a prospect to keep an eye on next season, as his ability to shoot from the perimeter is a valuable skill to build off. Really interesting. So let's look at the NBA draft that Cotton was a part of. This is the 2014 NBA draft. Cotton goes undrafted. Here are the point guards, and I know this is not really fair to do it because you could select anyone or any positional player with any draft spot you want, but I want to have a look at the point guards that were taken. And they are in order as Elfrid Payton, Dante Exum, Marcus Smart, Tyler Ennis, and Shabazz Napier. They are the point guards drafted. So put Cotton where you feel. Could he have kept up with some of these players? The 2014-15 NBA season is the first year of Steve Kerr's coaching with the jump shooting team of the Golden State Warriors that win 67 games this year and the NBA championship. So Cotton is entering the NBA just as the sort of three-ball analytic jump shooting revolution is just taking place. Curry has brought it to the attention of people, but it's not seen as credible at this point, and I don't think that's unfair to say. As Bodner said, where Cotton lands is critical. He lands in Utah with the Jazz, owner of 6 point guards, principally among them Trey Burke, who plays 30.1 minutes per game this season, and Dante Exum. It's amazing. We had Scotty Wilbekin before, playing great defense on Cotton in the tryout, and now we have Dante Exum consuming 22.2 minutes per game in Cotton's rookie season. And you've also got Gordon Hayward still with the Jazz and Joe Ingles, who also somewhat encroach on the responsibilities of Cotton's position, that point guard spot. Cotton plays 15 games, 10.6 minutes per game in those 15 games. His shooting percentages hold pretty firm at 42% from the field and 35% from the three-point line. I mean, you can imagine you're a rookie coming into an amazing league, coming off the bench in difficult circumstances, spot minutes where you've been at Providence and playing the whole game. You know, it's tough to maintain your averages and percentages under totally different circumstances. My question to you guys out there is Cotton the victim of entering the NBA prior to the three-point analytical revolution? And is he now stuck or the victim of the NBA entering an era of positional size? Is he the victim of defenses being a little one-dimensional in how they play team defense at this point in 2014-15? The bottom line, I think, is this. Cotton can shoot off the dribble or out of the pick and roll, or even just picks off the ball. He can shoot, and shooting is the most valuable offensive output in basketball, and I think we're just realizing that. It's funny, so often the emphasis on basketball was on, you know, can he run well? Can he control the ball? Can he ball handle? Can he rebound? Shooting is most important in basketball, and that's what we're coming to agree to. The offensive team, when you have the ball on offense, you have it in your hands. You can control exactly where it goes. You can pass it to someone. You can shoot it. You can hold the ball if you want. When you're on defense, you have some exertion over the ball, but not to the same degree. The rules favor the offense. It's an offensive game. So shooting is the easiest way to put points on the board. And if you can do it, it should be deemed the most important. Rebounds don't put points on the board necessarily. Shooting does. It is now beginning to be deemed as the most, not exclusive, the most important thing in basketball. He's an NBA talent, I think is what I'm getting at the end of the day. I'm going to keep looking into this as to whether Bryce Cotton is the best NBL player ever. There's a lot of tape to be watched. But what I will say is in the event that, and play this little mind game with yourselves, in the event that you had to start an NBL team, and you can take all the players who've ever played in the NBL ever in a fantasy draft, and you're trying to build the best team, Bryce Cotton is the first one I would take. Putting aside all the defensive things and da da da, I feel like he's the guy who you want to go to war with. He's the guy who's most going to turn a game for you and win it for you because his ability to make huge shots and just shoot teams out of games. But still at the same time, be a dependable teammate, an unselfish teammate, and a serviceable defender. Does this make him the greatest of all time? You know, just because he answers that question doesn't necessarily make him the greatest of all time. There's resume, there's what you've actually done may carry greater weight than who you're taking a fantasy draft. And it's very personal. But I will go back and have a look at Loggins and Ricky Grace some more. Now let's actually dissect Game 3. Game 3 seems so far away at this point, but I want to talk about it anyway. It was a great stat by James, and I won't say his surname in case he doesn't wish me to, but James on Twitter, James F, put up a really nice little tally of points, total minutes, total steals, rebounds of this series, and it was really good to look at, and a lot of work would have gone into it, so I appreciate it, James, and definitely punch it in and see if you can find it on Twitter. To summarize what James put up, minutes was the thing that most stood out to me. Cotton and Kay have played 100+. I think Cotton about 104, Kay about 101, something like that. Flipping the coin, Sydney Kings, their top minutes getter is Casper Ware, 90 minutes. So just in the finals, he's played a quarter less of basketball. Jayshon Tate has only played 78 minutes. Now, I'm all for, you know, rotations being quick and sending people through the game in and out a lot. That's fine. But your total minutes should still be more than that for Tate. He was getting around about 27 minutes a game. He needs to be in the 30s. Is there a reason why he couldn't go that long? I know he's a bigger player and he expends a lot of energy, but to me, he's a 30 to 35 minute player, minute a game player. Newley, 70. Lish, 70. Bogut, 69. We saw a huge drop-off from the Wildcats elite to the Kings. And like these 78s and things, I think they're less than Tarico White. Or very close. Quickly now, I want to do a minutes comparison of all NBL first and second teamers that are in the finals. So, I mean, Tate's getting 27.2 minutes a game. Nick Kay, 31. Patterson got 29, but hit him at the finals. Cotton, 34.6. Machado, 32.7. Casper Ware on the second team now, 30. DJ Newell, 33.4. Scotty Hobson, 31, but hit him at the finals. Cam Oliver, 30. Bogut, 21.5. I mean, that is a huge drop-off. But you look at it, the Kings, their best. And guys who made these all first teams, doing it with relatively limited minutes. Tate in almost half a quarter less of basketball. Really amazing. Let's have a look at the substitution tallies and patterns of Weaver and Gleason on Game 3. Brad and Body on the Brad and Body podcast did a really nice examination of this. Definitely go and have a listen to them. But nonetheless, I'll do it here. Gleason, and this is quarter by quarter, 9, 8, 8, 9 for a total of 34. Will Weaver, 9, 15, 12, 25 for a total of 61. Wow, it's a lot of substitutions. Not saying it's wrong, but I've never heard a rationale for why he's doing so many. Also, 25 in the fourth quarter, there is an element of putting in the bench players at the end. But still, if they account for 5, it's still double what Gleason made in that fourth quarter under the same circumstances where the game was in garbage time and out of reach. Body Nodge, who's been on the podcast before and of the Brad and Body podcast, had a really, I think, a pretty valid assessment of Will Weaver's coaching that needs a little bit of greater talk. Will Weaver has 2 years coaching, head coaching experience in the G League, and Body makes the point that a G League coach or the reason for the G League is to give NBA scouts and coaches a look at players. So there is that need to play players a relatively equi amount of minutes so they can get a look in. And I feel like a little bit of that thinking may have filtered its way through to the Sydney Kings. And, you know, only because Gleason's not doing the same strategy. But as I said, no one has asked Weaver, why do you substitute in the way that you do? Is that a cheeky question to ask a head coach? Seems to be. I don't know. Deshaun Taylor on Cotton is the next thing I wanted to write about. And this is the big what if for this series. Sorry, scrap that. The second biggest what if of this series. The biggest being what if it was allowed to continue to its precipice and conclusion. Deshaun Taylor on Cotton, though. What would this series have been like if he had been there? Twofold. Not only because I think Deshaun Taylor is the best defender on Cotton. I really do. Maybe even more so than Casper Ware. It's not just because of that, but also because of Casper Ware's shooting struggles.
would Casper Ware have played the 30, close to 30 minutes he's been getting if Taylor was there? Probably not. And it would have been interesting to see, you know, Bruce and Taylor, whether they'd sort of split minutes or maybe play in tandem at times. As I said, this is the big what if for me, the series. And I refer to you a quote, and I don't have it. I'm going to have to paraphrase from Phil Jackson's book, The Last Season, which chronicled his final season with the Lakers, the year that they lost in the championship to the Detroit Pistons, 2004, I think. In it, he wrote, the 2004 Lakers cut Tyronn Lue in favor of a bigger player. I think it was Josh Powell, thinking that Rasheed Wallace was the danger man to throw bodies at in those finals. But it eventually turned out to be finals MVP Chauncey Billups, who was the difference maker. And in the book, Phil Jackson even says, and I think he even says to Tyronn Lue, we made a mistake cutting you. We should have kept you. Your ability to be a something different to throw at Billups defensively may have helped us win this series. And he identifies that as the biggest reason they didn't win. I think there's probably more to that, but it's certainly a consideration. And I feel like this is the relationship between Sean Taylor and the Kings in a nutshell. And it's sad that no matter what way it happened, we won't get to see it play out. I want to put this out there to everyone. Casper Ware, why is he struggling? He's been the second best point guard on the floor. It's just by a distance greater than Earth's yellow sun to Pluto. Such is the gravitational pull or the cosmic big bang that is Bryce Cotton. Whoa. It's kind of poetic. I like that. That's all I've got for you this week. I feel like that's enough. We've run 45 minutes. I may even do another one once this decision comes out. Seems like it's going to come out in a couple of hours, but this is something to listen to get you through. Before I go, I just want to say to everyone out there, support sports. Jobs are getting cut left and right. People from Fox Sports all over and some really talented men and women in the field. So please support sports. You know, some really great, talented, funny and entertaining people and professionals have been let go. If you love or like something, embrace it, you know. Please. And, you know, it's going to be fun. Wash your hands. Social distance. Thanks very much, everyone. We await the NBL's decision. And a reminder, everyone, if you enjoyed what you heard, rate, review, and subscribe. See you in the near future.